Welcome to the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast, sponsored by WebSpy. It's January the 11th and 2010, and this is episode 225. And today we're going to do our first MBP roundtable for 2 years. It was January 2008 when we did this before. And I'm joined today by two other gentlemen. There's going to be three, but one had to drop out. Unfortunately, he came down with the flu. But I'm joined by Landon Michelson. Hello, Landon.
Hello.
So Landon is a passionate photographer who enjoys photography in some way every day. And his day job is as a lead designer with a lot of photo making and using layouts. And Landon also owns Best Kept Secrets Photography on the side. So it's great to have you on the show again, Landon. It's been a while.
It's been a while.
It has. And today, new to the round table, we have Dan Newcomb. Welcome, Dan.
Hi, how's it going?
Great, thank you very much. Obviously, both of you have been prominent figures in the community, you know, the MBP community on the forum, etc., over the years. But it's great to have you both on the line. And Dan, you'll know him as Mr. Nikon on the forums. And he's a photo enthusiast from Vancouver, Canada. And the day job as a technician keeps him, in telecom industry, keeps him pretty busy, but always making time for his photographic passion. So we've got a couple of topics to talk about today. And I would like to say before we start that there's a couple of photographs that we'll be looking at. I'll probably embed them in the Enhanced podcast, but the best thing to do is probably to go over for show notes and everything as well. Go over to the blog at Martin Bailey, well, blog.martinbaileyphotography.com, and then you'll be able to see the images and grab the show notes there. If you're not at a computer, you know, maybe pick up on those later. But we're going to talk about a couple of topics, and we're jumping into those in a moment. But before we do, I'd like to say a huge thanks to our sponsors, WebSpy. WebSpy are internet monitoring, analysis and reporting specialists. And as usual, I'd like to ask you to tweet the message thanks to at WebSpy for sponsoring the at Martin Bailey Photography Podcast on Twitter to show your support. To find out more about WebSpy and their products, go to webspy.com/MBP and use the discount code MBPWSY for a 10% discount on anything that you buy. So today, we're going to talk about a couple of topics, and we're going to start. Let's see, who wants to start? Or this is always one of those things that we... Let me tell you what we're going to talk about. So Landon was going to talk about how do you learn to make photographs. And Dan is going to talk about his amazing time-lapse photography. And then I'm going to jump in with a question that was actually aimed it's about mine and Landon's photographs. So we're going to, obviously it's a round table. We'll answer this together, but it was really aimed initially at, Landon and my own photographs. And the question was, how do we make our photographs pop? So we'll get into those in a moment. Shall we, does anybody want to go first or shall I?
Anyone?
I don't mind going first. I'll tell you what mine is. Mine's a top 10 list.
Okay, that sounds great.
And there's plenty of points in there. And if we don't get through all 10, we could certainly put them in the show notes. But I just don't know how long we'll spend on these topics.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what, you jump in, Landon, and we'll, if we take time, we take time. If it goes over, I'll split it into two episodes so that the people can, I'm sure that the listeners would like to hear as much as you can give them, Landon. So,
okay.
Do you want to take it away?
Yeah. I was asked recently, how do you learn to plan to make good photos? So many people, it seems, just grab a camera and go shooting. No planning, no goals, just serendipity of finding something worth pointing a lens at. This is so opposite to my way of thinking. At first, I had no answer to give them. I had to really think about it. You can tell people to go make a goal, to have a vision, to plan, to set a project, but how do you start this way of thinking? So that was where I sat down and I just wrote out a bunch of things on a bunch of sheets of paper when I was in between other things, and then I kind of collated them into a set, and then I rewrote them and collated them again. So I have a top 10 list that I thought would be good discussion points. And number one is, how do you learn to make good photos? Item number one: collect inspiring work. It just seems obvious to me that if you're not looking at inspiring work, if you're not, you know, making bookmarks of them, if you're not putting them into a folder, if you're not printing them out and looking at them, how do you know what inspires you to make a photograph? So if you, you know, if what you have is eye candy in front of you, might get your creative juices flowing.
Oh, you know? I agree. Yeah, that's a good point.
And
absolutely.
Approach or emulate a style until you develop your own. If you don't have a style, how can you develop one unless you have something to aspire to? You know, it seems like an obvious place to start. Some people right away go, "Oh, this is I love to do this," but some people don't. They don't have an idea. They just point their lens at something and hope they get something. And then get ideas. Execution usually cannot happen unless you get the idea first. You know, if you don't have an idea, what are you shooting for? So to me, it's like, you know, the idea can come from the aspiring work. It can come from the approach to a style. It can come from a new, you know, camera, something to, you know, to get you thinking.
Yeah.
So thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I just agree what you're saying there.
I totally agree as well. I think that, I mean, for me, I love my gear as well, and it often can give me a little bit of an extra bit of incentive to get out, you know, use that gear, and I often buy new gear to answer or to get over a certain problem. And so usually by the time I've got I get a new lens or a new piece of gear, it's because there's something that I want to do that I've not been able to do to that point. And so I'm really trying to rush out and do more of that. It's a very valid point.
Okay. So item number two, look at photos. Look at 1,000 photos. Take 1,000 photos. Look at 10,000 photos. Take 10,000 photos, etc. If you're not looking at photography and you're not taking photography, how can you learn to make good photos? It just seems, you know, to me, that's like an obvious first step, but some people just don't start there. You know, they just go out and start shooting, and then every once in a while they see photos and they go, "Oh, I kind of like that and I'll try that." But to me, if you actually make it a plan to actually dive into the process of photography, shooting photography, it can really help.
Sure. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, if they're not out there physically doing it, I mean, how do you learn? How do you create? How do you, you have to actually be out there taking the 10,000 photos to get anywhere, basically. I mean, Well, the first 10,000 might not count, but the next 10,000 will be really good. But
yeah.
You have to first take the first 10,000.
You know what, Landon? You're thinking about this. You're probably already helping to answer the question that we're going to take later as well on how do you make your photos pop, because a lot of the advice that you're giving now is really what I think we're going to be talking about later as well. So.
I think some of these points could really dovetail into that as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And then topic number three was what fuels your drive to create? And once you figure out what fuels your drive, then refill it. Is it mastering a setting? Is that what drives you to go out and try something? Is it controlling an idea, you know, getting an idea and then trying to control the execution of that idea? Is it exploring the unfamiliar? You know, for me, it's often I hear somebody say, "Oh, that can't be done." Or it's already been done. Well, that just drives me to prove that that's not the case. You know, the why or the what if can be a great tool to motivate you to create something.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, for sure. Yeah.
Then number four, instead of random, have a plan. It seems easy, but how do you do that? Well, make a task for yourself. It could be anything, really. You know, shoot for a theme or an assignment. You need to narrow your focus. Tell a story with your photography. Put a part of yourself in your work. If you're not in your photography, then you're probably not making good photos. Not necessarily you as the person, but you behind a camera. But you can put yourself in there too if that helps you. And then take one thing at a time. Don't try to take it all in one big chunk and think, "Oh, I have to master these 1,000 things before I can make a good photo." It's not about those 1,000 things. It's about executing on part of it and doing it well so you can migrate to the next thing. Because the learning curve is huge. You know, but once you start climbing the learning curve, you can start using that foundation for the next level.
Yeah.
And that's the thing with photography too. Oh, sorry, Martin. It basically, like, once anyone gets the nuts and bolts of how the thing works, your basic exposure, it's just, at that point, you don't actually learn photography. You say, oh, I've learned photography, now I'm going to try painting. Photography is just, it's a lifelong learning curve that just never ends. It seems like once you learn something, there's just the next layer and the next layer, and it just keeps going. And it's been a lot of fun over the years, and it's just one of those lifelong things.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I noticed a lot. The internet is bringing so much information to people that, it, you know, obviously it's a great thing. We can get, we've got access to information now that we never had. And I think that the learning curve is becoming shallower and shallower. Although there's a lot to learn, it's definitely being helped by that, by the internet. But I also see people these days that spend so much time online trying to figure out how to do it that there's no way they can be getting out and actually doing it. And you can see from the images that some people come out with as well, then they're not able to apply it as fast as they can learn it online. So, you know, going back to what you were talking about earlier, Landon, with the, you know, shoot that first 10,000 photos. I think that, I mean, if you've got time to look at everything online, do it at the same time if you want to, but don't give that preference over getting out and shooting, because really, those first 10,000 shots are gonna help you to get a much better second 10,000.
Yeah, absolutely. And if they're disposable, get them out of the way as soon as possible.
Yeah,
hit the delete button.
Yeah, the delete button's been one of my second favorite buttons on some shoots. You know, well, that didn't work.
Yep. Start again. Yeah.
Okay, number 5. Find a sense of purpose. You are one point of a triangle. And the triangle is, point number 1 is the world, point number 2 is the craft, and point number 3 is the artist. So if you can grow in your knowledge base of any one of those three, you're probably going to have find a better sense of purpose for your photography. So if you know yourself as an artist more, that's going to help. If you know the world that you're shooting, that's more. If you know the craft of photography, that's going to help you more. So as you grow, you can run those three tangents and really, you know, help get yourself a sense of purpose for what you're doing with your photography.
Yeah.
And photograph what you love.
Yeah.
What moves you? If you're just getting started in photography, or you're just getting started to try to make something with photography, if you're not passionate about it, if you don't like it, if it doesn't motivate you, you're probably not going to do well with it, and you're probably not going to make great images of it. So start with what you know, start with what you love, and what motivates you.
You know what, Landon? While you were talking a moment ago, I wrote down a quick note to raise this afterwards, and it says, photograph what you love.
Yeah.
it's so true. If you don't love what you photograph, if you're not incredibly passionate about it, it's not going to show in your work.
Yeah. Now later, when you've done that, you can stretch your limits and photograph what you're uncomfortable with. But
True. That's,
yeah. Find
maybe maybe it's a square. Maybe it's not a triangle. There's that unknown. No? Sorry. Yeah. I wrote down a triangle as you said that, so... But that is one good point about the comfort level. Once you do, you know, get to a certain level, it really does help you grow if you push your boundaries into new territories.
Yeah. The last point on this one is find an inward vision or passion that gets you creating. So if you don't find something that gets you out creating, then you're probably not going to make good photos because you're just not tying the two together. So you've got to find something that's in you that gets you out there.
Absolutely.
Number 6, make it a priority. Make time for photography. Get out shooting often, daily if you can. Don't just, you know, say to yourself, oh, I got 30 minutes at lunch. Now what do I do? You know, if you want to grow into it, you got to stick with it. Like we said, it's not a destination. It's a journey. You know, you've got to stick with it and not give up with it. But you have to make it a priority. And sometimes making photography a priority means you have to sacrifice something else. And for some people, that's a hard thing to justify. Well, I want to do better, but I don't have time for it.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if you can have both. You know,
yeah.
You can't be better at driving if you don't get out and drive. You know, you can't be better at baking if you don't learn how to bake.
Yeah.
So you got to sacrifice something sometimes to get better at it. And it's just a fact of life, I think.
Yeah.
You know, for some people that might be, you know, not doing something else that they like doing, or spending time, you know, finding time that's their own time to do it instead of thinking they don't have the time. But number 7, never be satisfied with yesterday. Because if you're satisfied with yesterday, how are you going to grow and be better? You know, if you made lousy art yesterday, go make it better today. Yeah. You made great art yesterday, go make it better today. Yeah. Self-criticism keeps you from just giving up. Because if it's just about the goal of making a good photo, well, you're probably going to give up because you're never going to make a good photo. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's got to be a process, you know.
Whoops, Landon.
Oh,
Landon.
It's got to be a process.
Quiet there. Sounds like we've lost Landon.
I think we lost him.
There he goes.
I guess he call back.
Yeah, I'll call him. I'll give him another call. I can see him.
He's still green on me. On
The wonders of modern technology.
That's all good.
So
need some music in the background here. It's like we're on hold.
Yeah, yeah. Did we get you back, Landon?
Oh, it says call failed online.
Ah. Oh, yeah.
Well, he got 7 out of 10. That's pretty good. Let's just make up the other ones and then see if he likes them later. No,
yeah.
I'm kidding.
Yeah. So while he's off, let's keep it going for a while. And you know, I think you know, so far the points that Landon's touched on have been great, and I of course, as we expect, I'm going to keep on pressing the call Landon button as we talk. But I think, you know, that those last few points about you know, being passionate about what you photograph, I definitely agree with that. I think that, you know, people can get caught into the act of photography. I mean, I can understand that for me, even if I've had a rough week, if I can just get out with the camera, just pressing the shutter button is stress relieving. And I, you know, I really enjoy photographing anything, but I'm at most with my photography, and I can get into the zone easier, and I produce better work when I'm shooting stuff that I love. And that's usually for me the nature photography, wildlife, nature, landscapes. And so yeah. I think that, you know, we definitely excel at what we love, and it gives you, if you've got a certain amount of passion for something, then it definitely comes through in your photography.
Oh, I agree. Like I myself, I know I work like 80-hour weeks. Sometimes I go 7 days a week for like a month or whatever. So, I mean, you really definitely have to make time. You have to make the time to do it.
Yeah.
And I, you know, push myself every moment I have. And I love the summer because it's light out later and I can actually do some good stuff after work. But yeah, I mean, it's he was talking about motivation as well. My best picture is always my next picture. It's not my last picture. It's always, what am I going to shoot next? That's what always keeps me going.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, the experience of, wow, what am I going to get? And then the excitement over new photos. That's always, I'm not always usually looking backwards. It's always looking forwards.
Yeah.
And, it just keeps you going. I mean, and again, like you said, you got to photograph things. And he said, you got to photograph things you like, and no one wants to sit around and take pictures of things they don't like. You won't be very motivated to do that. So
it is
important to find out what you like. A lot of people like photographing people. For you, it's nature. For me, it's nature, I guess, too. But yeah, I mean, you just have to take a camera with you and just have it with you and try to figure out what things you like when you're first starting out.
Yeah.
And one way or another, you'll gravitate to one genre or another. And yeah, you just keep going.
I totally agree. I know that for a while, when I came to Japan, when I first came to Japan in 91, I had been, well, actually I should step back a year or two before that. I had been shooting landscapes. I started to get into hiking and walking in the hills in Derbyshire back in England. And I took a little cheap plastic camera with me, and I started to really enjoy just photographing the scenes that I was in, that I was seeing. And then when I came to Japan for a while, I was trying to concentrate on shooting this amazing new culture that was around me with the temples and shrines and things. And it wasn't me. I enjoy shooting them, and I still do every so often now if something really sort of gets me going, you know, gets my juices flowing. But
sorry about that.
Hey, we've got him back.
Oh, he's back.
Yeah. You know what, Landon? You'll have to listen to the podcast to figure out what we've just said.
But we didn't make up bad stories about you or anything. It was all good.
But we've kept the conversation going here. And I was just talking about when, you know, we were talking about the shooting what you love and, you know, kind of carrying on from your discussion. And I was talking about how before I came to Japan, I started to get into photographing, you know, landscapes and the scenery around Derbyshire in England. And then when I came to Japan in 91, I initially started to photograph the beautiful new culture around me, shooting the shrines and temples and things that are very Japanese. And that was catching my eye. But it wasn't long before I felt as though I wasn't enjoying it. You know, I wasn't really enjoying doing that sort of photography. And I got a car and got mobile. And the first thing I did was started to get back out to the mountains and to photograph landscapes. And then I started to get into, you know, a little bit more trying to shoot flowers and things. And then only after 2000, when the digital SLRs started to become something that we could afford, I started to get into macro and then really started to develop from there. But it was very easy for me to gravitate back to nature. And then, you know, as I could add a few longer lenses to my arsenal, as I like to say, I started to get back in. I started to get into wildlife photography. And so you definitely gravitate to what you love. And so, you know, that's basically what we were talking about.
Cool.
Absolutely. But actually on that point too, is when people start off with photography, I mean, they may not know what type they like. It's basically get out there, experiment with people, wildlife, landscapes, and just see what you actually gravitate towards, like you're saying.
Absolutely. I think that for me, it wasn't a conscious decision. It was just, I mean, that's why I do like the word. I mean, you mentioned it, Dan, but you know, gravitate, you're pulled towards it. It's not as though you always need to find it and it just clicks. You know, sometimes you can be just pulled towards it.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
I think we're up to point eight over there, Landon.
Well, I know where I left off.
Okay.
So let's pick it up. At the end of seven, we were talking about harsh critique after self-criticism. So if you get a harsh critique, you need to grow from it, because that photo is already made. You need to make the next one. But when you get a critique that's a little harsh, it feels really bad at first, especially when you're first starting out. But you know, when months go by, years go by, you look back at those things, and those things stick in your head, and those things have a tendency to stay with you. There's almost always something you've gained from those types of moments where somebody says, "Ah, nice photo, but you know, you really messed it up here."
Yeah. You know what, Landon? I think you were probably talking to a dead mic for a moment because we didn't start that conversation.
Gotcha.
I think what happened was you probably dropped off because we heard you come to a natural end for seven, but we didn't hear anything about the harsh critique. So,
gotcha. Well, that's where I made my note where we hadn't got that far. Yeah. So
okay, no, that's I totally agree though.
Totally. Yeah, agree. And it does hurt too.
Yeah,
but you learn from it and you have to. You want it after a while. Like Flickr sometimes, it's not the most critiquing atmosphere. Not that I have anything against Flickr, but everyone's always like, great photo, great photo. You don't learn anything from that. You learn from actual negative feedback and positive feedback, I guess. But you sure learn from the negative more than the positive, in my experience.
I think that the, you know, critique, I have two ways of looking. Well, maybe it's just all part of the same way of looking at critique. But I take critique probably in two ways. The if I get critique that clicks, if I get something that someone tells me and I think, oh wow, yeah, that's spot on, I will assimilate that and I'll make it my own. But I find that for that to really work, it will definitely. I just saw Dan's note there.
Sorry about
so,
that.
It's okay. I'll forward those on in a moment. Okay. So let me think. So basically I'm much more likely to take critique from someone that I trust or I admire. And I find that, you know, if that's not the case, then I still listen. And I think that you've always got to listen to what people tell you. But whether I take it on board or not is a different thing. And like I say, I mean, it has to click. It has to sort of, I remember a number of times, Landon, you've helped me with images where you've, one that comes to mind is the one of the, I think it was a chrysanthemum. I did a close up of a chrysanthemum, and you mentioned, you know, do you like the dark corners? And the moment you said it, I mean, I had actually thought about cropping that out, but I think I left it, or I cropped it down not as much as you said that it would work with. And then I thought, you know, he's right. I went away and I cropped it down a little bit more, and it looked 100 times better. And so, I mean, it's being receptive to it is, to me, it's partly, you know, how much you trust the person that you're hearing the critique from, but also I think it's whether or not it just clicks. It doesn't matter who tells me something. If I hear it and it just says to me, you know what, they're right, or at least prompts you to go and try it, then that as well can really work. But the other side of it is that if something doesn't click, then I just try to politely sort of move on. I don't have to agree with everything that everyone tells me. Everyone looks at the world through a different filter. Everyone has a different idea of what's good and what's bad. And so, you know, if we didn't, we'd all be shooting the same images. So, you know, as in the same way that we all shoot differently, we all have different tastes. And so, you know, you can't try to assimilate everything that everyone tells you, or otherwise we'll either all end up shooting exactly the same way, or it'll all just turn into a big mess, you know. So definitely, right. Yeah.
The only thing I wanted to make sure of is that, you know, when you're a newbie, a lot of people are afraid to even start getting critique. They're afraid to give critique. They're afraid to get feedback. They're afraid to give feedback. You know, your mom will tell you, oh, it's a great photo. But, you know, what is the industry or the, you know, the photography people around you think of it? Right. And it's a great way to find out if you're on track, if you're progressing, if you're doing something well, if, you know, if you're patting yourself on the back, but nobody else is, because you're not an island. You know, yeah. There's a whole bunch of people out there that can help you. And photographers love to talk photography. So, yes. And we're doing it now.
Absolutely. Yep.
But with critiques as well, I guess.
I wanted to say.
Sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I was just going to say with critiquing, I guess, you got to put yourself out there and want to be critiqued, like you guys are saying. But I guess my point is, I forgot my point.
My point
is I'm going to get Landon to talk. There we go. It just went away. Sorry.
That's okay. I'm just saying that it's a space that you can grow from. If you get to that comfort level where, you know, I've made a great photo and I want to share it to the world, and next thing you know, people, you know, go, okay, but try this, and this. You know, maybe you'll learn from it. Maybe you go, yeah, but I already made the photo and that's what I liked. But sometimes those things stick with you, and it just helps you grow.
Oh, I think I remembered my point finally. Everyone's got a different point of view on like a photograph. I mean, I've had people critique things and I just didn't see it at all. Like, just, hey, what's that guy doing in the background or whatever it is. And it's just that second point of view. And it's great to see that. And to also, for new people to photography, the good thing to do is to actually critique photos. To do that, basically all you're saying is your point of view. Oh, this is what I noticed first, or my eye keeps getting attracted to this upper corner, or things like that. And it's not that you're right or wrong. There's no right or wrong with photography or critiquing. It's just how you see that photo. And by sharing that and doing it over and over and over and over again, it actually helps your own photography. It's almost like teachers that teach a lot, they actually get things back while they're teaching from the students. So
if you want to learn it, teach it.
Yeah, there you go. Or wait, isn't it, if you can't do it, teach it?
I've heard both. I thoroughly agree. You know, one of the things I'm lacking in critiquing skills. I don't do it enough. So I definitely agree with that. I'm okay at talking about photographs, and I do try to sort of do a little bit of a at least a critique or a comment on the images that win the assignments. But I don't think I'm all that good at it. So I totally agree with you there.
There's no right or wrong answers, but anyways.
Yeah.
You want to move on to number 8?
Yeah.
Sure.
These last three will be pretty quick, I think. Number 8 is embrace failure. Learn from your mistakes as well as the mistakes of others. Experiment. How do you know until you've tried? Mm. And 100 failures could just mean enlightenment is just that much closer.
Sure.
I heard Sean Penn say that in Milk a few days ago, but I'm not sure I want to try it. That's true. My mom used to say that, you know, don't knock it until you've tried it. But I think a lot of things are a case of jumping in and giving it a go and seeing if you like it. And this is probably also related to the, you know, finding your style point. You know, you've got to just try lots of stuff until something starts to really take root.
Yep.
Yep. Absolutely.
So number 9, how you learn. If you learn by doing, go do it. If you learn by reading, go read it. If you learn by seeing, go see it. Then go shoot it. You know, if you don't know your learning style and you just sit there and go, I don't know, the internet's out there and there's a lot of stuff and I don't really look at it. And, you know, I've been to a workshop, but it really didn't inspire me. Maybe it was the wrong one. And, you know, people just languish in this, sometimes in this unknown land of learning. You know, just find how you learn and go employ it and maximize it. I mean, the resources that are out there today are so vast. Yeah. That's just amazing to me, the amount of photographers that are doing stuff. They've never even listened to a podcast. You know, they've never been to a forum. They've never, you know, they've collected a few photography books and they've tried a few things. But there's just so many resources nowadays.
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yep.
So number 10, push the envelope. Plan to be successful on the next shoot. Plan to have good lighting.
Yeah.
Plan to put the best elements together for success. And if it is comfortable, you are likely not pushing and growing.
Mm. Good point.
Yep.
Yeah. That's it.
That's top 10. There we go.
That's cool. Great. That's an amazing list, Landon. As usual, you've done a man's job, sir. I'm quoting Blade Runner now. So you know, I think a few things that I would like to sort of tag on there. Obviously, everything that you've said, I agree with. I think we've had a little discussion about most of those as we came through, so I'm not going to jump into a big monologue myself here. But I, you know, the actual act of planning as well, I find that planning what you're going to, you know, what you're going to shoot. Say if you want to go out and take a sunrise, then, you know, you don't want to be getting to your location and then trying to figure out what time the sun rises, you know, or where. So I think that, you know, the tools that we have these days, like Magic Hour that I love on my iPhone, these things will help you to find out where the sun's going to rise, what time. It'll tell you the moon rising and you know, fall and all of that. So the actual planning of the physical details of your shoot as well is something that I think people don't often do enough. And you know, we probably could lead into the other conversation that I was going to do, you know, that we were going to talk about with the question, because part of the answer, you know, is how do you make your photographs pop? For me, is also planning to be at a certain place when the light is going to be right. And, you know, I think that a lot of the time, in fact, you know what, I'm going to save this and just we will talk about this as part of the discussion around my photos. So I don't know if Dan, you have anything else that you wanted to add.
No, it was a pretty good list. There's probably a million things I'll think of after the podcast, but no, I think that Landon covered it really nicely.
Yeah.
I had lots of other ones, but like I said, I just picked 10.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's good planning. There you go.
Absolutely. Yep. Absolutely. Okay. So then let's do that. Let's lead into my question there. Well, I say my discussion, but it's obviously for everybody. And what it is, I had a question from a friend who, you know, I know that Landon, you also know this guy. I hope I don't butcher his name here with my pronunciation, but for a listener, Jared Fain, has asked, basically, I had a nice conversation over this week with Jared, and I basically, it was, you know, what makes Martin and Landon's photos pop? He named us both in the email. excuse me. So, you know, basically this email came across from Jared. He's saying that he's frustrated that although he takes care to watch his histogram and get a good exposure, his images are bland and lifeless. He wanted to know what makes mine and Landon's images really come alive and have depth and good contrast. Now, let's see where to start here. So he also, Jared sent us two sets of images, and these are going to be on the blog. So definitely, if you're not there now, check that out. It's blog.martinbaileyphotography.com. Jared uses a D300, and he shoots in RAW, so there's nothing wrong with his equipment or the way he shoots. And he uses Lightroom and DxO to process the images. And one of the things that Jared was talking about was his histogram. And I opened both of the originals in Lightroom, and I'm going to just take a look at that now as well. And I've got to tell you, the first thing that I want to say is, Jared, your histograms are perfect. If I take a look at both of them, the after, we've got a before and an after shot, and both of them, the before shot, have perfect histograms. And these are just basically exported JPEGs that he's done nothing to. And the left and right, you know, the peaks of the histogram are all contained between the left and the right. You're not clipping either the shadows or the highlights. You know, these are model histograms. So the first thing I want to say is that, you know, really, Jared, your exposure is perfect. I don't think you could do a better job. The thing that I was starting to lead into earlier was that, you know, I think that part of the problem is the time of day that Jared chose to shoot. So here's part of my advice. And the thing that I should note as well is that these were shot on a holiday in Ireland, and Jared was with his wife, I believe, and it was really not a photography shoot. So, you know, the thing is, if you're going to shoot at times like that, it's sort of a byproduct of another activity, then maybe not expecting to get something that looks quite like mine or Landon's images. Because generally, and obviously Landon, you know, would jump in at any time, but if I want to shoot an image like the ones Jared has sent in as only example shots, although they're beautiful, that, you know, I should make a point that they're only examples, but I wouldn't shoot them at the time of day that has that flat light, or maybe, you know, it has a very nice sky. I may choose to shoot these images because the sky is beautiful, but I wouldn't expect them to come out of the camera looking like the post shot, you know, the before and after. So time of day, or shoot what you can, what's available, but then expect to do some work in it on post processing. Have you got anything to add there at that point, Landon?
Well, I've looked at the photos and I've got them up now. You know, the one thing that strikes me right away is just time of day. You know, they're contrasty. You know, you've got this bright sky clouds, and you've got this green verdant landscape and rocks and valley and seascape, you know, going out in front of you. And we're looking at the same photos, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And to me, it's just time of day.
Yeah.
You know, you could help it with, you know, a graduated neutral density filter. You could bring the sky down maybe slightly. You could, you know, you could do some more things. You could bracket the exposures. You know, you could go into Lightroom and add you know, graduated filter there and help, you know, pull some interest back into the clouds and stuff. You know, they're not bad photos at all.
Right.
To me, it's more time of day. And when you're on a trip and you're with other people, you don't have a lot of planning ability around time of day.
Right. That's exactly what I'm thinking. I mean, I think I even did a podcast a while back on, you know, how to get reasonable shots when you're out with others and you don't have the time to, you know, you can't get up at dawn and go out and get the best light, or you can't hang around until the sunset. Or, you know, there is always going to be things that prevent us from shooting the images that we really want to. And if you've got the time to get out there at the right times for the best light, go for it and shoot and get your Ansel Adams images. But if you're out and you can't be shooting at those times, then just accept the fact that they're gonna be a little bit flat, they're gonna be a little bit bland. And if that's all you can do, still do it, but just expect that you're gonna have to rescue the image a little bit in post-processing. And I think that, you know, looking at the after shots that Jared has sent in, he's done a good job of that. There are a few other points, and I don't know, Dan, do you want to add anything before we move on to the other points here?
No, you guys are doing just fine.
Okay, great.
Sorry.
So, the other things that I was thinking about, you know, these shots are, you know, they do look great. But on talking with Jared, it seems that he was doing a few things that were possibly destructive before finishing off back in Lightroom. So this is a takeaway for people that may be doing something similar. I gather that pretty early on in the process, Jared was exporting all of his images to DxO, having DxO do a little bit of work, not only on, you know, fixing like chromatic aberration, things like that, but also you know, correcting lens distortion. So he did a lot of that very early in his workflow. And of course, once you do that, you're working on JPEGs or TIFFs or whatever. You know, you're working on something that is no longer non-destructive. And so as the moment you take those back into Lightroom, and then Jared was playing with the profiles, you know, the DNG or the raw profiles, under the calibration tab. So selecting maybe landscape instead of standard. And also, I think that he has the Dojo plugins, and they have more punchy profiles that you can apply to the images. If you do all of that after you've exported and run something through a product like DxO, then you're losing the benefits of working directly on the original RAW file. And that's a bit of a no-no. You know, you want to do everything that you can that you're going to do with the RAW file before you export. And if you want to do anything after the export, then expect it to not be quite as good as it would be if you could do it earlier in the process. And I think that, you know, I should also mention that a lot of the time, for portrait work, I don't do this. I don't do a lot of portrait work yet, but for portrait work, I don't. But for anything else, pretty much anything else, all of my wildlife and nature and landscape work, I apply a preset that I created in Lightroom, which basically adds plus 25 on the, I think it's a 1 to 100 or a 0 to 100 scale, or a 0 to plus minus 100 scale, in the calibration tab. I add plus 25 saturation on the red channel and plus 18 saturation on the green and the blue channels. And this is basically something that I found gives me a very velvier look to my images. And in my slide days back in, you know, that I just recalled the smell of slide film, and it was very you know, I took a little mental trip down memory lane there. When I was working with slide film, I used to use a film called Fujichrome Velvia, and it was very punchy. It had very strong reds, and it was very saturated, and so I like that look. And generally, most of the work that you see on the site, on my website, will initially have had plus 25 red and plus 18 greens and blues added. And this also emulates very closely to the Canon picture style, which is landscape. And I'm sure that there's an equivalent for the Nikon cameras. You'll have to excuse my incredibly British or Japanese pronunciation of the word Nikon, gentlemen. But I generally add that saturation, and that also gives my images a bit of a punch. And I used to add 50 to everything, but I found that as the cameras have started to give us a more punchy image, even straight out of RAW, they're capturing data better now. I've found that I don't need to add 50. But generally, I'll add this 25, and if things look a little bit over the top, I'll bring it back down. But, you know, obviously my idea of what's over the top and other people's idea may be different, but generally I'm doing that. One of the things that I did want to mention there before we open this back up again, is that I am at the moment experimenting with the color checker passport from X-Rite. And this is also giving me very punchy shots. It's the moment I apply a profile, and I'll be doing a podcast on this within the next few weeks, but the moment I apply a profile, the blues and the reds and the greens all just jump out at me. And so I may well be adjusting my workflow here. As long as I've got a shot of the target, you know, the actual passport that has the little cells with the greens and the reds and everything on there, if I get a shot of that while I'm out, I may well be changing my workflow. But until now, it's been basically adding that. And also making sure that the defaults for Lightroom are not changed. Because by default, Lightroom will add 5 on the black slider. It'll add a medium contrast tone curve. And it'll do a little bit of sharpening for you at 25, I think, out of a 0 to 100 scale. And so, you know, Lightroom is helping you by default. And then if you want them a little bit more punchier, make a preset that has these other things and just apply it on import and then start to look at your images from there. So that's the post-processing side. I do have a few other things, but I've been talking for about 50 years at the moment, so open it up for conversation again. What do you think, guys?
I think we lost Landon there, but I just actually checked my email and I see the photos you're talking about now. So
okay.
I'm just catching up real quick. Actually, the before and after, there's quite a difference, and that the after is a lot punchier. It looks like you did a really good job on this. I mean, I can tell that the saturation's been boosted, the contrast, sharpening. It's such a much better photo, the after. But I do agree, the time of day would have definitely made a difference. But yeah, that's pretty nice. I'm just looking at him now. So
yeah,
he's back.
So we were just, you know, we were just saying I'd finished my 50-year monologue, and Dan had just made a couple
done
of
my 22nd one. Yep.
I got a couple of thoughts.
Okay, so do you want to take it away? I've got a few more things to talk about this before we finish, but take it away, Landon.
Okay, the only thing I was going to say mainly was, you know, when you work with RAW files, stay in the RAW as long as you can in your workflow. Do everything you can while it's in that RAW state.
Right, totally agree.
When you've got your vibrancy, your saturations, your contrast, your curves, your manipulations, all that stuff, you do as much as you can in sharp, you know, in when it's in RAW. Then when you export it to DxO or NIC software or output to Photoshop or something where it's a destructive process, think of that being your last and final stage, not your first.
Right. You know what? I love being on the same page as you, Landon.
because then, you know, when you want to import your photos and you want to apply the camera presets, and you've got camera profiles that you can select in your camera, and you've got camera profiles that you can select in Lightroom that match, those only work for the RAW files.
Right.
You can't apply those back to a TIFF or a JPEG or a PSD file. Those only apply to the RAW file coming in.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you can apply them, but it just doesn't.
Well, they just don't. Yeah, it's not.
It doesn't
the same
work
thing.
The same. It doesn't work the same. So that's exactly. I mean, that's part of my advice as well.
Yeah.
I did want to just then finally just touch on
the time of day thing and all that. It's obvious, but
yeah. That's really it. I mean, just to summarize, you know, make sure that you if you want really punchy photos and you want the best, then do the extra work to get the best. You know, I know that Landon, you probably do this even more than I do. You know, just make sure that you get out at the right times of day. And shoot things, you know, carefully. Take your time, do the work in the field to create an image that's really, really outstanding. But then, if you do need to work on these things in Lightroom, all of the stuff that we've said is valid. You know, make sure that you can keep all of this in mind, because it may be the only way that you can get to the image that looks the way that you want it to. But you know, the tools, I mean, the one thing I did want to add before we finish, and you did touch on this earlier, I think, Landon, is, you know, like the gradient filters and or gradation filters and things, you can add, you can use these pretty much like a neutral density filter in the field, but you can use these things with exposure, brightness. There's all sorts of, in fact, I'm just going to click over. I've got Lightroom open, so I'm going to click over and take a look at this. But if I grab the call the neutral density filter, but it's a great graduated filter. You look down the list, you can see you've got exposure, brightness, contrast, saturation, clarity, sharpness, and you've even got color. You can select a color and make a bland sunset look really nice if that's the sort of thing you want to do. So, you know, there's a lot of powerful tools in Lightroom. And also you've got the local adjustments now. So if you grab that adjustment brush, you can do some dodging and burning with the same values that I just mentioned, and really do a lot of great stuff just in Lightroom. So I think that the point that I would like to make here for Jared is, take what you can, do a little bit more in the field if you've got the ability to do that. But, if not, take what you can and then just, expect to work on it a little bit to really produce your final image.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say, I'm not in the same league as you guys for sure with the landscapes. It's not my main thing I do, but I guess this is a bit of a cheat, and I don't know if anyone wants to follow it, but in the field, especially if the lighting is kind of like quite a dynamic range, I'll just shoot in HDR. I don't really, to be honest, look at my histogram on the back of the camera. I don't think I've looked at a histogram in about 3 years, I think. So I'm kind of lazy that way. I mean, I'll bracket 9 exposures on a scene like this, and later on do an HDR. But I don't like to overdo the HDRs, of course, because that has a whole different look to it. But I mean, I guess maybe that's why mine aren't punchy and your guys are, because you guys follow everything else. But
That's a great point, and I'm glad you brought that up, Dan, because I did have just a brief exchange with Jared about that as well. And it came from Jared, as in he'd said that he does that sometimes, but he doesn't really like the results. And I'm in that camp. I do the odd HDR, but I don't think it suits my photography. And although I appreciate it when I see other people's work, I think that people like John Shear, the guy that I interviewed a while back, does great HDR. And obviously, I mean, I've seen similar things from Landon, and I'm sure some of the images that I've seen of yours, Dan, are HDR as well. And I appreciate it, but I just can't bring myself to do it. And I know that Jared is the same way. So although it's great advice, and it's gonna meet with some people, some people are gonna say, "Yep, great, I'll go and do that." Some people don't really want to get into HDR at the moment, at least. So,
I understand that. Also, in certain subjects like this with the waves, you might run into ghosting and whatnot. So it might not actually work in this particular scene, but just something that popped in my head.
I did, I know, Landon, you mentioned this as well, and with your hybrid HDR technique as well. But one thing that I used to do more than now is to just shoot two images. But then, say if it's the sky and the land that have got a lot of contrast between them, I would just mask out the sky in one shot, and just merge two images together so that I could get a good sort of level contrast across the image, nice heavy sky but not too blown out, and then a nicely exposed foreground and the land, and that works as well. But I don't find I do that now anywhere near as much as I used to. Just because I can go into Lightroom and do pretty much the same thing with one image.
I've got a couple things just to add to this discussion before it tapers off into something else. But my process in the field is to capture, especially with landscapes, is to capture everything that's there. Yeah. I want everything that's there. I may change my mind and use one exposure of that. I might have some really cool technique in the future I had captured that sequence, because now I want to do this with it. Mm. So my goal off field with landscapes is to capture everything that's there, because I have limitations in the camera. I see something, or I feel, or I have a feeling about how I saw it, and that's what I want to relate to the viewer when they see the photo in the end. Mm. So for me, what I'm after is I'm field gathering, especially with landscape. With portraits, it's a completely different workflow. But with landscapes, I'm after everything I can get. I want to control everything. If I want details in the shadows, I'm going to shoot for the shadows. If I want details in the highlights, I'm going to shoot for the highlights. If I want details in the midtones, I'm going to make sure I got it. Yeah. When I come back from the field, I have everything. I might only use one 14-bit RAW file, process in Lightroom, and be done. I might take all the exposures, merge them once for the sky, merge them once for the foreground, merge them again for another detail area, merge all three of those back into layers to control my vision. And then add processes on top of that just to control how it looked to me. So I think it just depends on what you want and how your workflow is, but don't limit your field gathering to what your exercises are today, because I've had photos that I've pulled from the archives 5 years ago. You know, it's like, oh, I'm so glad I shot it that way, because now my workflow with this and these new tools, look what I can do now.
Yeah.
You know, so when you're on these trips, you know, go ahead and gather the stuff, even if you can't process it, you know, until you've learned what your workflow is, until you've learned what your style is, until you've really know how you're going to do it, what you're going to do, where you're going to go, what time it is, and take all those steps into, you know, until you get there, don't be afraid to take a few things, and even, you know, worst case scenario is delete them.
Yeah. Now, that's a good point to raise. I do the same thing. So definitely, totally agree there.
Especially if it's once in a lifetime.
Yeah.
Shoot every angle, you get it.
I often do that with a mind to create an HDR, but I just never end up publishing the HDR. I mean, I even throw them into Photomatix every now and again and try to see, you know, what I can come up with. And I pretty much so far have always gone back to just getting one that's got good, you know, good midtones, captured the highlights, but enough of the shadows to be able to just raise them with the what's the fill light. I love the fill light slider in Lightroom, because you can just bring those shadows out really, really quickly. But yeah, I think we've hammered this one to death. So I do want to thank Jared. You know, great question, and I hope that's been of some use to you and others that are listening. And by all means, you know, follow up Jared or anybody if you've got any more questions. Let us know. So are we good to move on, gentlemen?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. So Dan, take it away.
Alrighty. Actually, I'll ask you guys: Have you guys ever done any time lapse photography at all?
Yes.
I've done a tiny bit, not a lot.
I've done it in two methods. I've done it on video, and I've done it with digital SLRs.
Gotcha. Yeah, I've got, I can maybe give you a bit of a background here. Back in the 80s, when I first started photography, I just fell in love with still photography. But then even at that point, I saw a couple really cool time-lapse movies and was just taken by it. And it's been there ever since. But basically, still video. I'm pretty sure most people know this, but video is just made up of 30 still images. That's what makes it a moving photo or a moving video. So basically, 300 frames will make up 10 seconds, and so on and so on. When we're shooting HDR or HDR time lapse, we usually try to aim for 10 second shots at minimum, maybe 20 seconds, but. So back to the 80s, I used to make a film. Obviously, back then, video was kind of new, but I had an old Bolex camera that we'd kind of made into a time-lapse film camera. Nothing ever turned out all that great. And then over the years, video cameras claim they had time-lapse capabilities, but often what happened is they shot 1 second of video every however long the intervals were. And that always made it look really jerky. It wasn't really that great. Move into the early 2000s and with DSLRs, my first DSLR, Nikon D70, I rigged up an old Palm Pilot and had a little program that I'd run that would you could set the intervals to whatever, and it would talk through the infrared port. That worked okay, but the problem there was it would skip a frame now and then, and nothing worse than a time lapse. Video is suddenly something jumps and it just doesn't look very good. Up until, let's see, about 2006, I got my Nikon D200, and that was the first camera I had with a built-in intervalometer. So now we've got digital, which is great because it's, you know, cheap. It doesn't work out. You delete it. And this timer that was built in was wonderful. And so at that point, I started experimenting with HDR time-lapse video stuff, which is pretty neat, but boy, do you shoot a lot of photos if you're bracketing by three, or just there's three times more photos. In 2008, my brother finally bought a D300 and wanted to do some time lapse. I have a twin brother, and he's actually a professional cameraman for video. He's a local CTV cameraman, local news. So he's always been kind of the video side. I've always been the still photography side, but we kind of come together when it comes to time-lapse, especially with shooting with DSLRs. He's kind of into electronics and things, and so am I, but he's had a little more time on his hands. So he's built a number of different rigs that we can use with the time-lapse. He's built tilt and pan heads. He's got a dolly pole climber thing that'll either go vertical or horizontal. He's built a railing crawler that'll crawl along bridges and stuff. It's pretty neat. Actually, I have some photos I can maybe give them to you.
Great. Mark, that'd be great. Yeah, let's include
them. Yeah. Okay. But so basically, he's in the last couple of years, he's been getting pretty interested in that stuff, and that's getting me a little more interested as well. But I don't always shoot time-lapse, but when I do, it's pretty fun stuff. In 2008, him and I went down to the Grand Canyon to shoot. It was a time-lapse photography trip. We went down for 2 weeks and shot between the three cameras. I had my D700 and D300, and he had his D300. We shot about 130,000 frames. Wow. Yeah, it was quite a lot.
That's one shutter life right there. It's like
it is, and I was going to mention that both my cameras, my D300, D700, I actually took approximately about 150,000, and they both died. Good thing is they were under warranty, and I got them fixed for nothing. But but that's what we were doing to begin with. Like a couple in 2008, we were shooting mostly JPEGs and doing RAW with them. Lately, the last trip, we went down to New Mexico and shot the Balloon Fiesta in Albuquerque. But this time we shot RAW, and we found it was better for exposure and all that. Mm. We had four cameras, but we took a lot less photos, probably around 30,000. But I do have a link of our YouTube. I'll send you the link, Martin. But you can have a look at some of the stuff. It's just really neat and fun to play with. The other thing is I went and bought a, I guess I'm not sure I can be called Mr. Nikon anymore, because I bought a Canon point and shoot. and I know it's against my reputation, but anyways.
We'll have to call you Mr. Canon from now on.
Mr. Canon, there we go. After both my DSLRs went in for, don't call me Mr. Canon. I quit. I'm hanging up. No, I'm kidding.
I love this.
The dumb thing I did was, I liked Canon point and shoots. I had a Canon point and shoot a long time ago, but I decided to buy the G10. But stupid me, I mean, I heard great things about the G9, and I just rushed out to the store. I was up north in northern BC and went into a little store, and, okay, I'm going to get a G9. Oh, there's a G10 now. Okay, I'm going to get that one. And I was all excited, and then I got the thing home in the hotel room. I'm looking at it, and, sure enough, it doesn't have time-lapse capability. I was hoping, because of a rangefinder, it's not taking the shutter's not flipping every time, the mirror, so it's a lot less hassle. But I did end up getting a little remote for it, so that's kind of neat. But I haven't used it a lot. But the reason I got it was, again, I wanted a point shoot, but also for time lapse, it's pretty cool. But it is pretty hard on equipment.
Yeah.
The other quick thing on just with time lapse, if anyone wants to do it, I mean, any digital camera will do it, as long as you have either the built-in thing or an external timer. The another thing, the workflow, I mean, basically I'll just shoot a bunch in Lightroom. I'll do just general color correction, maybe a little bit of contrast or whatever I have to do. Then I export it as a JPEG. In Photoshop, I'll just tweak a little bit more and then downsize it in Photoshop to 1920 by 1080, which is full HD. Mm. And that's downsizing it quite a bit, of course, as you know, with working with raw images. And then Pinnacle Studio I use, which is the video thing. There's a bunch of different programs out there, Premiere or even, what's that called? Can't remember the other one, but there's any photo video program will work. You just have to set your still images for importing them instead of usually about a default of 2 seconds, just put it down to one frame. Mm-hmm. And then you just export away and there they go. That's, you got time lapse.
Yeah. Well, is that Sony Vegas, the other one you were trying to think of?
No. What's the After iTunes? iMovie. I heard people do that with iMovie, but I'm not sure what it spits out at the end. Usually we want to spit out HD, but there's also Premiere, Adobe Premiere.
Yeah. And Final Cut Pro on the Mac.
Final Cut Pro, there you go.
That's probably what you were thinking
of. They're wonderful programs. But so basically that's my little spiel on time-lapse. It's a lot of fun. I mean, if you've got the equipment, it is really hard on equipment, but make sure your camera's still in warranty.
You've got to either really hammer it and get it to break while it's still in under warranty, or be very careful. So
exactly. Yeah. But time-lapse, yeah, that's pretty neat. But
make lots of money and just an expense.
Yeah. I tell you what, I should say that I love your time-lapse work, Dan. I've seen the links. I've seen a number of the movies. I will put a link to your YouTube page on in the show notes, so people definitely should check that out. Cool. Beautiful work.
I've seen them all too, and I have a couple questions.
Great. Sure, go for it.
Number one question is, I'm a manual mode guy. You know, probably 98% of the time I'm shooting in manual mode, but with time-lapse, if the scene's not changing light dynamics, it's pretty easy to shoot manually. You just set it up and off it goes. Yep. What do you do in the cases when you've got a scene that the dynamic range changes greatly because you're over many, many minutes or even hours? What mode are you shooting in to get your sequences so it doesn't ramp up and down and up and down and up and down, you know?
Yeah, a lot of times.
As the light changes.
Yeah, a lot of times we'll shoot, well, just in aperture priority, but if there's a certain part of a scene that you want the exposure to basically be based on, we just usually select, what am I trying to think of? What's that mode? the light meter, the spot meter, thank you. There we go. Spot meter. But the neat thing with I don't know if Canons work this way, but the Nikon, you can move around, of course, your focus point, but that's also your spot meter point. So when you're doing a time lapse, if you want the building or whatever, you want that properly exposed, you just pop it on there and then maybe plus or minus what you want. But it generally, of course, you do get a lot of time exposures that are time lapses that don't come out. I mean, it's almost like it's not quite as bad as if you shoot 100 to 1 with still photography. You might get shoot 100 and get one good one, but still you get shots that just it's impossible to get the dynamic range. But that's part of the reason why lately we've been shooting RAW, so we do have a little more control over that. Whereas before we were shooting mostly HDRs, and man, the processing is just nuts. To do 300 frames, final frames, sometimes it would take 24 hours to process through Photomatics. So it's just nuts. Next question.
Okay. So the next question too is, it's more of a statement than a question actually, but when you're shooting at these high resolution frames compared to even 1080p or something, right, you actually have more resolution than you need. So in doing so, you have a couple options. You could just downsize it, you know, downsample it and stick it on there. You can also zoom. You can pan across those pixels. You can rotate inside those pixels. You know, you can do all kinds of stuff with that clip footage once you have it shot. So you're not totally stuck with, you know, that 1080 footage.
Absolutely.
You can do other creative things with it too.
Yeah, there are programs out there that'll do it. My brother, myself, we don't do a lot of that, but there definitely is programs that'll, like you say, rotate, zoom, pan, all that kind of thing. Plus, having them shot in the full RAW later on, like 19x20x1080, I mean, who knows what the future is going to bring. Maybe the resolution will go up a lot more, and then we still have the RAW images.
Yeah, if somebody wants to license a 2K or a 4K image for cinema reasons, you've got it.
Exactly. And we actually do, there's a link at the YouTube thing, but there is a guy actually in town that has a stock footage time-lapse thing, and we've got most of our shots on there. And sold a few things over the last couple of years, and it's kind of neat. But I'm not going to quit my job tomorrow and start doing it, but a little bit of income coming in from that, it's not too bad. Pays for itself, yeah. I guess.
Excellent work, so.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. But it's a lot of fun. I don't actually own a camera right now that'll shoot video with my still camera, because I always seem to have it separate. But time-lapse seems to have its own little category that I don't mind wrecking my couple of cameras for. So.
Yeah, the other thing that comes to mind too is if we could get a point and shoot that doesn't have a shutter that flops up and down, have an operating system that has ways to control that camera to the nth degree for capturing time-lapse, we could actually get cameras that, you know, more cost-effectively and don't have that hardware limit of running, you know, killing them. We could we could really have some cool tools at our disposal.
Well, the G9, Canon G9 has a built-in intervalometer, apparently.
Right.
The G10, of course, doesn't. But yeah, a rangefinder camera. Absolutely, because, yeah, it'd be... I've done a little bit with the G10, but not as much as I thought I would. But, you know, it's a Canon, so just kidding.
I hear people, too, all the time, you know, they're taking these little point-shoot cameras, especially the Canons, and then they replace the operating system on it with a card, boot off the card, and now they've got all these cool tools like an intervalometer right inside the camera. They can do all this time-lapse stuff that didn't ship with the camera. But
oh, very cool. You got to love those camera hacks. I like it.
Yeah, but the cool thing is you just pull the card out, reboot it, and it's back to normal.
Oh, that's neat. That's cool. I'll have to look into that because carrying around the external thing is a little funny, but yeah. Neat.
Okay, next quick question. You set up through these time lapse, they take hours.
Yeah, depending on the scene.
What do you do while you're waiting for the thing to click away? Are you shooting other things?
Oh, I'm having a nap usually, but because you just set it and forget it. So usually I have two cameras going myself, and my brother now has two cameras. So generally, if you're setting up a scene, you're looking around for other shots, and it's always the way if you just got one still camera and you're taking still shots and you know you've got it all set up, there's always something else going off to the left or right or behind you. But it's the same thing with the time lapse, but it does take a long time. It depends too what you're shooting. Like we'll shoot sometimes one frame a second if it's fast moving things, up to maybe one every 30 seconds, and those really can eat up a lot of time. But and you hope no one bumps the camera, and had that done too, like you're 2 hours into it a shot and you're only halfway through, like you're only got 5 seconds and someone like bumps your camera, it's a little aggravating, but things happen, I guess. But yeah, basically just look back, kick back, look for new angles, and that's how we deal with the time, I guess.
So do you have to worry about any security or anything with this gear when it's running, or are you right next to it the whole time?
Oh, usually right next to it. We've also... My brother printed up some laminated cards that says "time lapse in progress. Please do not touch." And in brackets says "you're being watched." So sometimes we'll step back and you know see if people read the sign. But everyone always wants to look through. We're at Bryce Canyon or whatever, and everyone's like, "What are you taking a picture of? And can I look through?" And it's like, "Okay, just don't touch the camera." But
conversation piece.
It is. A lot of people do go like, how many pictures are you taking? Because the thing's clicking away one every 3 seconds or something. It's like, I think you got it. But no, we're doing a time lapse. It's going to get put in a video. And yeah, so it's fun to do. I mostly just shoot it on these little trips to the States. But I mean, I'll shoot the odd thing here and there. But my main love still is still photography. But it certainly is something to neat to play with, and I'm by no means an expert in anything. I have to do a waiver, don't I, or something? Please do not do this if you want to wreck your camera, blah blah blah. So anyways, it won't wreck your camera, but it's just the other night I went out shooting for about 8 hours with time lapse and shot 7,500 pictures, so it adds up.
Yeah.
Does anyone want to buy a Nikon D300 or D700 low mile?
Yes, but not from you.
Not from me. I'm going to have a hard time selling those cameras, I think. Yes, thank you.
that's great, though. I really do love looking at these. So just a reminder that the link to these movies is going to be in the show notes, so check that out. But that's great. We've been going for an hour or so now, gentlemen, so... probably start to think about wrapping it up. I did want to just ask if you've got a little tip or something to a little nugget to give the listeners before we finish. Does anyone have anything?
Yeah.
Well, go ahead.
I got two little things. I got my Radio Popper Junior X Studio radio triggers the other day. Mainly to control the ramping up and down of my alien bees so that I can adjust the value of the output on top of the camera. So I don't have to pull the light stand down, adjust the light, put it back up, take a shot. No, pull it back down, adjust. It was such a pain. I don't have to do that anymore. So that's a little tip. And then the other one was I got my Color Monkey photo calibrator. And I love this little thing.
Yeah.
It's so easy and slick and cool, and it just works. You just plug the thing in, you know, put the software in, plug it in, run through the stuff, and I feel more comfortable now than ever with my screen calibration. Not just the color hardly changed at all, but just having better control over the luminance, you know, and the contrast of the monitor, and it does it all automatically with these new monitors and video cards. It's just so cool. Right. And then you can, and then being able to calibrate your printer. Being able to calibrate, you know, right down to the paper style you're using, and it's just so cool. So great. I'm just having fun with it. I've only had it a few days, but
how long does it take to run through a screen calibration, Landon?
The first time I did it, it took I don't know, maybe 4 minutes, and then the second time I did it was like 2 minutes.
It's just checking.
It's pretty
changes.
Quick.
Yeah,
great. It's pretty quick.
Wow, great. I have a Spider too, and I've got two monitors at the home. Set up here, and I calibrate the thing. Maybe it's something I'm doing, but I swear they both look different. And then I calibrate my laptop, and all three don't match. But I'm partially colorblind, so maybe that's got something to do with it. But
I had a Spider too before this, and I could never get it to make my screens match, and I could never get it to work very well with these super bright these LCD screens. So it was time to upgrade.
I guess you'll never get them as a sponsor. Sorry, Martin.
it's just really what good. I found personally. So
yeah, me too. Just my personal.
Other people love it. I just didn't find it to work for me.
Yes.
Well, that's great. I might well be trying that myself. So, Landon, where can people find you?
They can find me at any time. BKSecret.com is my main website that points to everything else. You can find me on the Twitters at BKSecretPhoto. I'm on Facebook if you want to find me, and I'm on Martin Bailey Photography galleries and forums daily.
Yep, and very much appreciated, I must say.
It's a great community. I can't afford to make my own, so I spend my time in yours.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you do, because everyone would go to yours if you weren't there. So.
No, I'm not that crazy.
So, Dan, do you have anything?
I was just going to point people towards, I can give you a link, but it's super long, so I won't read it out, but, just for intervalometers on, eBay, you can basically pick them up for most cameras, roughly around anywhere from 30 to 40 bucks. And, I'll give you the link, but that was my little pick of the day, just to tie in with my time-lapse stuff.
Great. Amazing. So I wanted to, something I touched on earlier, I wanted to just suggest the X-Rite Color Checker Passport. This thing is amazing. Like Landon, you know, it's a little bit of calibration, a calibration tool that I've got into recently. They're less than $100, and they come with a bit of software that you basically run either in Lightroom or on the desktop, which creates a DNG profile for you. So you can apply it just like you would do, and like the Adobe landscape or standard profiles, things like that. These things, they work just the same. And they're created per camera. It does mean that if you're out with a number of cameras and lenses and things, you have to shoot the target a few times, but it works really, really well, and I'm very impressed. So, and as I said, I'm going to be doing a podcast about this over the next few weeks. But X-Rite Color Checker Passport, check that out if you're interested.
I'm interested.
Cool. I'm interested.
Yeah. Or just try to get third, fourth, or fifth place in the current WebSpy and Martin Bailey Photography assignment, because we've got three of these things that we're giving away for the, like I said, the third and the fourth and the fifth place. So
excellent.
But to be honest, I think, you know, I wouldn't like to wait 5 months to get hold of one, because that's how long it's going to take you to get through the next five assignments.
I was going to, real quick, too, if the Color Monkey photo rebate, I took advantage of, because it ended on the 31st of 2009, and then they extended it 3 more months, so there's still a $50 rebate.
That's good to know. Is that marketed by X-Rite as well?
Yep.
Okay, I think I'm heading over there after this. All right. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. It's been really nice talking to you both. I love both of your work, and also, you know, really appreciate your contribution to the community. So it's been really nice talking with you today.
Cool.
Great.
All right. Thanks awesome. Very much then.
Thank you, Martin.
All right. Cheers.
Okay. Have a great week.
Yeah. You too.
You too, Landon.
Bye.
Bye.
The Martin Bailey Photography Podcast is a proud member of the Photocast Network. Find this and other great photography podcasts at photocastnetwork.com.